Hello, everybody. This is Pete Havel, and welcome to Gas, Glue, and Guardrails, the Culture, Leadership, and Career Show. I am the president of Fireproof Leadership. That's my workplace culture and leadership training, consulting, and speaking company. I'm also the author of The Arsonist in the Office. If you ever want to contact me, connect with me in any way, go to the show notes, and all my contact info for social media and everything else is there. As with every show we do, I want to bring on guests who make you think, who've learned things the easy way and the hard way, and people that will teach you things that will make you assess your life, your career. Think about ways that you can make yourself better, and you're going to hear some extraordinary stories of guts, purpose, and character. Our guest for today is Lisa Bowman. She's resilient. She's tenacious. She's talented. She has been an extraordinary player for major organizations, and we're going to get into it in just a little bit. She's written a book that, frankly, I can't tell you the title of. Why is that? Because I have a child. She is 19 years old. She is an adult now, and she remembers everything. I will just tell you the title. We'll get into it in just a second. It is a little bit gritty. It is very real. It is awesome. But my outstanding daughter, who's a Dean's Lister, University Scholar, Bell University, all those wonderful things, and she's remembered extremely well that I've said on a few different occasions. Okay, here's the words we don't use as a child. So she remembers that. And when I toss out a word every once in a while, I get in trouble. So Lisa Bowman, welcome to my show and tell me the title of your book.
Thank you, Pete. I love that story. So happy to be here. The title of the book is Harasshole.
I was honored for you to ask me to write a foreword for it. Awesome book, amazing story, and just excited to have you on today, and I'm proud to call you a friend. If you have not read Lisa's book yet, encourage you to do so. It's available on Amazon and everywhere else. We're going to provide you details in the show notes where you can get that information, but encourage you to buy that today, read it, and learn from it. Well, tell me a little bit about yourself, where you're from. We're going to get into the story that has made you an author, a leader, just respect in the workplace and in culture. But tell me a little bit of your story, and then we'll dive into the deets.
Thanks, Pete. You're really feeding my ego here. I mean, come on, you were a published author before I even was. But I was born and raised in Chicago. I grew up wanting to be a journalist and an attorney. And what I really wanted to be was a reporter that was reporting on big, high-profile legal cases. Life takes you in different directions sometimes. So a little bit about me and how I grew up. I grew up in the Chicago suburbs. We moved into the city when I was in my teens. I went to a very, very large public high school, but only after spending a couple of weeks at a private Catholic school. And the funny twist to that is that I'm Jewish. And so my parents sent me to Sacred Heart Academy. I don't wear plaid. And oh, I did funny. Learn from that experience. No, the only plaid I wear is Burberry. The only people on this planet that one cannot negotiate with are nuns. Like you cannot get anywhere with those folks. So as I tried to explain to them that I'm Jewish, I'm not going to religious studies. The deal was I'm supposed to be playing ping pong or something during that time. Yeah, that didn't work out. So
that is funny. My growing up, my mom at times was a piece of work. I, as a child, I'm sure was too. But she would go the nun route of things with virtually every direction on kind of a big ticket item in terms of something that was just really important to her. She would invoke God to back her up on stuff that the Lord has told me this. So basically, if you ever went against any type of direction or disagreed, you were kind of matching up with Satan on your side, which just was kind of tough to argue against.
I love it. Love it.
So can you get an education right there with the nuns? And then you found yourself in Atlanta?
Actually, no. So I ended up going to school. I did my undergrad. I started off at Drake University in Des Moines. For my first 2 years, I finished up at Columbia in Chicago. And then I met a boy whose family was from Atlanta. And that's ultimately how I ended up here. I did go to work for UPS. I spent 15 years at UPS in a variety of different things. Probably the thing I used to say that I'm most proud of, but I don't think that's accurate. So I think the most visible thing that I did at UPS was to launch the UPS store for UPS.
How cool is that?
So often we go to work and we do things and you never see what you do publicly, particularly at UPS, right? We move packages. I never got to see the people receiving their packages. That's on the backside, but to all of a sudden see almost 4,000 locations of mailboxes, et cetera, carrying the UPS shield and converting to that brand, that was a very tangible thing for me to see and to touch. And so it was great. I had a lot of really amazing marketing roles, but then ended up in the UPS Foundation. The chief human resources officer had approached me and asked if I would be interested in taking a role in the foundation. The foundation sat in HR, and no disrespect to the HR people, but no self-respecting marketer wants to find themselves working in HR, right? That's just not how we roll. But I was really intrigued with the idea of using my skills as a marketer, right, to raise up visibility of UPS's good work in the community.
Sure.
And so I went to the foundation essentially as the CMO of the foundation, but I also had an investment portfolio, a $20 million social investment portfolio oriented in the DEI space. And then I was given a little gift with purchase when I arrived day one on my job. And that gift with purchase was that I was told that I was going to take over running the company's United Way campaign. And that terrified me. I don't do sales. I'm not a salesperson. And so having to sell United Way and get our employees to give their personal money to something like that was terrifying for me. I think my biggest fear was that nobody would ever sit with me in the cafeteria again because they were afraid I was going to hit them up for a donation.
In a lot of organizations, it is both. It's a point of pride. It's something voluntary, but also mandatory, is right. It's that that tug of, look, this is completely up to you. But when you give, we will appreciate your generosity.
100%. I remember when I started at UPS, and I had no idea who United Way was. But during my onboarding with HR, you know, in the mountain of paper in those days that they slid across the table to me, one of the things that they gifted me was a United Way pledge form. And I remember very clearly the HR person looking at me across the table and she said, "We have a long history of supporting United Way. It's part of our culture. And we are sure that you will want to support United Way as well. So here's a pledge form and it has the recommended amount for somebody at your level to give. But of course, it's completely optional." So I filled out the form, gave it back to her, smiled, and I said, "Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to contribute." Life works in funny ways because that was my first introduction to United Way. And then ultimately I ended up there.
Yeah. So tell me about that process.
Yeah. I loved what I was doing in the foundation. And as much as I always say, like, I don't do sales as a marketer, right, which they'd never had in the foundation, by using a marketing approach and really just treating United Way like a product, creating a value proposition and marketing it to our employees. The United Way campaign grew in the 4 years that I had it by 35%. It went from 48 million to 65 million. One of the things about UPS culturally is that they move people around a lot. I was really hitting my groove, loving what I was doing in the foundation, and again, got tapped on the shoulder by the CHRO to take on a new role, which was to develop UPS's global communications strategy and statement for human rights. And out of the blue, I got a phone call from the CEO of United Way, who was looking to bring in a new CMO and asked if I might be interested. He said, "Oh, you've already shown me, candidly, that you know how to market United Way. And before I go spend six figures with a recruiter like Korn Ferry or Heidrick or whatever, might you be interested?" And I remember going home that night and telling my husband that I had had that call. And he stopped and looked at me and said, I think you should take it. And I said, "Well, I haven't even had a chance to process it yet. And you're telling me I should take it." He said, "I've seen you doing the work that you've done in the foundation. And you have this energy that you bring to it. You light up when you're talking about that work. And I think this is a way for you to fully step into doing something with your skill set." And he was absolutely right. And that's why I made the decision. And it was a tough decision to leave UPS. I mean, let's face it, people don't go work at nonprofits because of the amazing salaries and the wonderful benefits package. You know, you go there because you value the mission and the work that they do. And for me, making that transition, hard as it was to leave, I knew that I had an opportunity to use my skill sets as a marketer to make sure that some person somewhere, someday, was going to have a better tomorrow.
And it is, and we're going to dive into the what I think is a two-edged sword, because today we're going to be talking about workplace culture. We're going to be talking about careers. We're going to be talking about mission-driven organizations and that thing you talk about that people are drawn to the mission, but also they get confused between, are we protecting the mission or are we protecting the people? And that can really cause some problems. So let's jump into that, fast forwarding into a little bit of your story of what prompted you to write a book. Tell me just briefly, which is a tough thing to do, encapsulating your life in just a couple of minutes, but walk us through what caused you to, frankly, put your career at risk. Tell me the Lisa Bowman story.
Yeah. So thanks for the challenge. So I took the job at United Way in late fall of 2015. Everything was great for the first 2 years. Loved what I was doing, you know, never looked back. Quite frankly, it was my dream job. And then in fall of 2017, I was asked to interview a candidate by my boss, the CEO, for a peer role in the executive team. From the minute that I interviewed this man, and I won't even use the word gentleman, I'll just say man, things were really off with him. He was inappropriate to me during the interview. I shared my feedback with the CEO that I thought that this candidate was technically competent, but socially awkward and, you know, may have some liability for us because of his behavior. I was ignored. He was hired. And from the minute he came on board, he began harassing me. And I put up with it for about 15 months. I know for a fact he was harassing other people as well. There were numerous complaints. One of the HR directors had done an investigation on him, turned it in, was told to stand down, and then she was terminated a few weeks later. And in February of 2015, I ultimately had to go to HR because he was inappropriate towards two women on my team who had reported it to their manager. They and she subsequently brought it to me, which required me to take it to HR. By policy, I was obligated to go to HR. I went to HR and was told it would be addressed a couple of weeks later. I had to go back to HR on my own behalf because he had just finally crossed a line with me. And from the minute that I reported this, those two times in February on behalf of those other women and myself, the CEO began a systemic pattern of retaliation against me. I was told to fire a high-performing woman in my team, the woman that was the manager of these other two women. I refused to do it because there was no reason for it. I had resources taken off of my team. My performance reviews were downgraded with no substantiation, the standard playbook that happens, quite frankly, in retaliation. You know, retaliation happens 75% of the time when women report sexual harassment. But fast forward to February of 2020, slightly before the world tilted sideways with COVID, final act of retaliation, I was wrongfully terminated and decided that, you know, I was not going to take this sitting down. So I engaged an attorney. I filed with the EEOC. I was afforded an opportunity to take this public via the media, which I did in November of 2020. There was pretty solid media coverage of this. Ultimately, in February of 2021, the CEO, you know, if you could see my hands right now, I'm making air quotes, but he resigned, presumably under pressure from the board. And then I was approached by a publisher about writing a book. And while I really didn't want to write the book initially, I felt like if I did not share my learnings and my journey with so many other women and some men that go through this every single day, that was a little selfish of me, that I had learned a lot and I had an obligation to share that with others. And so I wrote the book, which actually dropped, I think it's a year ago, next Friday. So it dropped last March. It's been out there for a year. And, you know, it's been good. I've had a lot of people that have read the book that have said, thank you for helping me navigate this. Thank you for helping me see my own situation in what you went through. I know it's not just me, because I think so often we get gaslit into thinking as women that we're being too emotional, we're being too sensitive. This didn't really happen.
Yeah.
But the number of women that I've had that have contacted me and said, like, same, same. It's been crazy.
We were talking about how the guy I had on last week on my podcast, Ashley Yablon, how his story was one of international intrigue and FBI getting involved, all these kind of things. Speaking up, how you and I identified very much with his story because those ingredients are always the same. I want to touch on something, dialing back to what you were discussing in the early introductions. We're going to dig into everything more in just a minute. But for HR people that are listening, somebody that's on a board of directors or a CEO who looks at all the HR people stuff, harassment, all of this in kind of a light way, what you talked about in just your first year on the job is there was retaliation. You're having money taken off the table for resources that frankly fueled the organization. The lack of insight that leaders have in terms of how much culture things, not dealing with bad behavior inside an organization, just starts taking an organization down a path of shooting itself in the foot, certainly hurting its own people. But you have somebody that seems to be acknowledged by many people as a problem. And your reaction to that is, I'm going to ignore the problem person and start going after virtually everybody else. Obviously, people knew that you were having a problem. Your coworkers were having problems. The people around you were having problems. What did you see it doing to your peers when they're watching you come under assault? They see their budgets slashed for trying to do good things. What's it doing to the folks around you as well?
So it really, and you know, you're exactly right. When something like that happens to somebody, it does impact culture, right? It starts with culture on that team, but then that can permeate throughout the organization. And so in my case, as resources, both human and financial, were taken away from me, the work was not taken away. And so it was crushing my team.
Yeah.
Crushing my team. And I really think that the intent was to just wear me down to the point where I would quit. He placed a bet in the wrong direction because I don't quit. And so we just slogged through it. I mean, it was the typical stuff, right? My team was getting burnt out. They were under enormous pressure. And it was beyond the kind of stuff that donuts on a Friday and pizza on a Wednesday and an occasional, you know, cocktail outing after work can fix. Yeah. They were completely beaten down.
And I'm guessing, I know I found, when I found myself in a situation, because I was managing people, I was leading a team, I was trying to get stuff done. And you're a professional, just like I'm a professional, and you're taught, okay, my job is to help the organization, I'm there to be a team player, but then you realize, okay, I have part of my organization that is trying to defeat me. How was it trying to balance you trying to get stuff done with knowing, okay, I'm the target here now. I've got the levers of power coming at me. What could you say to your team, and what did you hold back from your team in terms of the day-to-day? Look, we've got work to do, but also at the same time, there's an undercurrent, there's a battle taking place around you. What's that give and take from that time?
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing, Pete, is that I don't think in that moment I truly realized what was happening. It wasn't until after I lost my job and I stepped away and I documented everything that had happened that that clear pattern of retaliation had emerged. I knew that what was going on was targeting me. And I really truly thought that, okay, this guy, the CEO, is just trying to see if he can break me, if he can get me to quit. Because obviously I had now become a thorn in his side versus the person that was the actual problem being the problem. And so I think as a leader, you know, you have this bifurcated responsibility. You have a responsibility to the organization to get the work done and perform. Yes. And then you have a responsibility to your people, right, to support them. And I was trying very hard to straddle that line, to not let them see what was going on. I didn't talk about it at all. I think they all inherently knew because they had seen, they had observed this person's behavior with me.
And they see other people leaving.
They see other people leaving, right? They had made comments about his interactions with me, and I would just sort of avoid that and try and keep them pumped. And, you know, there were days where I told them, listen, guys, like, this is hard for me too, but we are one hell of a team and we're strong and we've got the best talent and we're just going to buckle down and we're going to pull through this and we can do this. And I have complete confidence in us to do that. And so during the day, and so remember, I commuted to DC. I essentially lived in DC during the week, every week, and commuted home on the weekends. So I didn't even have being able to come home and talk to anybody at night about this. I would keep up this facade all day in the office of strength and, you know, enthusiasm and pep my team up, all while navigating physically the office, trying to avoid this guy and reduce any interaction with him. And that was so stressful on me that I would literally go back to the hotel at night and just kind of collapse from the sheer stress I was under during the day, and then get up and do it all over again the next day. I think for me, it was really important as a leader to not have my team be impacted any more than they already were. I felt a responsibility to protect them.
So you are in a mission-based organization, and for folks that not familiar with nonprofits, you've got the staff, and there's always a little bit of a give and take between the staff, and then there's the other group. You've got the board of directors, who are the overseers that have the fiduciary duty, responsibility, whatever you want to call it, for, okay, you're there to both oversee as well as provide care to the staff as the staff does the day-to-day work. There's an interesting give and take in those organizations, and the way it is designed but breaks down depending upon the culture is usually that staff takes some guidance and they go and operate. In many cases, ideally, you've got the board as a group that kind of serves as a bit of a cop, if you will, for not an organization not going far over the line. They kind of reel you back in, move you around awkward situations, provide their expertise and counsel. But in a situation like the United Way, you have extraordinarily powerful people that are on your board of directors. In some organizations, your local chamber of commerce or small little charity in a community, on some of those boards, people are very much just the staff is excited to get anybody to join a board. But in the case of the United Way, you've got CEOs that are probably thinking, okay, this looks really good on my resume. I'm going to meet some other big shots. So it creates a bit of a dynamic. Tell me if I'm wrong on this, but it creates a bit of a dynamic of, you've got a board of directors who's not so much thinking, what am I going to be able to do for this organization? But you have boards of directors thinking, all right, this group is going to do a lot for me and I don't want to screw this up. Tell me what that dynamic is from the board of directors, how they operate, what they do, what are their understandings of what their role is?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you're right. We did have a very powerful board. We had CEOs and C-level resources sitting on our board from every big name company that you would know. Companies like Deloitte, U.S. Bank, Wells Fargo, Truist, which was formerly SunTrust, Whirlpool, Nationwide Insurance. Right? These are brands that everybody knows. And these are executives from these companies that sat on our board. And so I think that the tension comes in when that board is there for governance and strategic advisory perspective. But they also, right, they are the oversight committee, if you will, of that organization. The CEO reports to the board. And so when there is a problem, that should, in some cases, go up to the board level. I sit on boards. I sit on boards where we've had problems at the organization, and I've had to make those tough decisions. But I think in a nonprofit, sometimes when it's a big nonprofit like United Way, and you have these C-suite people from big companies, they've got a full-time day job. They are not interested in dealing with the minutiae, right? To your point, this is resume filler for them. It looks really good. I was on the national board of United Way Worldwide. It's the world's largest nonprofit. It's a $5 billion organization. Check the box. And so one of the things that I placed the wrong bet on, quite frankly, was that when the situation happened and after I was terminated, I actually went to the board before I went public with the story because I didn't know what the board had been told. And I went to them respectfully with a letter that detailed out a lot of the examples that were in my legal filings, saying like, don't know what you were told. This is why I was terminated. I have filed charges. You know, here's what happened. And I am asking you, I am practically begging you, for the sake of protecting this organization, to do something. And they ignored me. Absolutely ignored me. And the thing that was so discouraging, Pete,
everyone,
is that the board...
Was it literally everyone that reached out to? Stonewall.
It was everyone. The entire board ignored me. Men and women. And the thing that was so disappointing is that board was almost 50% women. And one of those women was a chief people officer at one of those companies. These people had seen me present in front of them. They had seen the results that I had driven. They had seen the awards that I had won and the impact I had made on this organization. And yet when this happened, silence. I suspect that the way this played out is that they were just told that I was terminated for whatever reason. The reason cited in the separation paperwork was that my role was eliminated and given no other explanation. Again, I can't believe nobody questioned that based on what I had contributed and the work I had done there. That aside, when I went to them with a letter and said, hey, you know, here is what happened and I'm asking for your help, they subsequently ignored me. About a month later, the media broke on this. And when the media broke, a group of roughly 20 former employees, all of whom were female, wrote a letter to the board. And I want to be really clear. I had nothing to do with that. These women did not work there during my tenure. I only knew two of them and in passing. The rest of them never met, never spoken to. But when they saw my story, they organized, they wrote a letter to the board, and they said, look, you know, what got reported on in Lisa's scenario is not unique to Lisa. We have all worked there at various points during the 20-year tenure of this CEO. And this has been the culture there. It is a culture that keeps women down. There is not pay equity there. Women are subjected to discrimination, to harassment. They gave examples. And they said, we do not want, we all stayed quiet. Right. And this goes back to one of the points you made. We wanted to protect the organization. So none of us said anything. We all just left or moved on. But now we can't stay silent anymore. And we are offering to help the board and be an external advisory council for you to figure out how to fix this so that the reputation of this organization stays intact. And the board dismissed them as well.
Amazing. And every one of these organizations, I would assume, that were represented there on the board, I'm assuming they have harassment policies. They had made public statements at some point during Me Too. But collectively, as a board of directors, which is both visible but completely anonymous, they punt, they take a pass, they whatever sports analogy, the swing and a miss. They are gonzo because, well, it's not my name literally on it. It's just a board decision and they can disappear into the wallpaper. Is that about right?
I think that's absolutely correct. And I would venture to say that the women that sat on this board, I would venture to say that in their organizations, they were leaders of the women's business resource groups. They were mentors. They were champions. They had brought other women along with them, right? They were talking the talk, but they didn't walk the walk, because every single one of them should have stood up. And the other thing is that we had a women's affinity group of 70,000 women that were donors to United Way. That group stayed silent too. They knew what happened. They stayed 100% silent. And this is a group that it was all women donors. They had cumulatively raised over $1 billion for United Way in a 10-year period and organized themselves around supporting some of the women's issues that United Way addressed. And they stayed silent. Not one of them came forward. Nothing. Nobody reached out. Nobody contacted me. All of a sudden, I was like toxic radioactive waste, right? Yeah. Get as far away from her as we can. And that seems to be the case in all of this, right? Your previous guest, Ashley, right? Different scenario. Same thing happened to him.
Yeah, it is a absolute pattern there. As I'm thinking about it on the what boards do, what they don't do, what kind of feedback or what kind of silence did you get when you came forward from the people that you assumed wrongly? Been there, done that, so I'm going to call it that. Been in that world. What did you hear or not hear from people once you spoke up?
I didn't hear anything. The manner in which I was actually terminated was, quite frankly, disgusting. My team members were told not to reach out to me, which I think is actually illegal. I never heard a word from anybody. I never heard a word from anybody at United Way. I never heard from a board member. I never heard from my team. Nothing. It was like I had ceased to exist.
Very, very common. You brought up an interesting point, and that is because there's been a story out there in the news from a different large organization, McDonald's, where they've had a lawsuit that that's been filed against them and their board. But in the case of McDonald's, they eventually went after their former CEO, who had sexual harassment, who had the HR department essentially being the bro-ish wingman to the CEO, who viewed all of his employee base as his dating pool. And eventually, once it was determined that, okay, we've got workplace misconduct, we've got a serial harasser, a retaliation statement, the board eventually did take some action, and now it's going through the legal system as it spun off. But the difference between a nonprofit board and a profit board is a lot more than just the word non. There's different interests in there. You've got skin in the game on the profit board. Talk a little bit about what you see is why you may see a corporate board work a lot different than a nonprofit board.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And, you know, one of the things that I realized when I made the transition from the private sector to nonprofit is that really the only difference that's there is the nonprofit tax status. Right? As a company, a public company, you have shareholders that are their investors in your business. As a nonprofit, your donors are your investors, right? They're just getting a social return on investment. They're investing in your program and your product to try and affect a better outcome. And so I was thinking about in the McDonald's scenario, they're going after trying to claw back the settlement that they gave to the CEO. In my scenario, there will be a lawsuit coming forward against United Way once the process with the EEOC is completed. However, the board essentially terminated the CEO, and it was positioned as a resignation, but that's the way those things go.
That's right.
If you look at United Way's 990, which is the legal paperwork that they have to file, you can see the payout that he received, which was almost $4 million.
Wow.
Now, what I would say is that United Way, they don't sell a product. They make their money from donors. That's donor money that just paid that CEO who was forced to resign for bad behavior. That's donor money that just paid that $4 million out to him.
And this isn't the first time around for United Way in terms of, from what it looks like, looking at that at that donor money as play money, as funny money, because there's been problems in the past. There's a pattern here. There's breadcrumbs that we're following that always lead back in the same way. Was there a point that United Way could have gotten this right, fixed it, and what does that repair look like? What is an organization that has got those problems, and obviously a board given a darn about things would matter. Hiring people with higher character at the top leadership levels matter, but where's the fix? What does an organization need to do to say we're not going to be them?
Yeah, and you know, I think with United Way, I think they fell down at so many steps along the road. In the book, I talk a lot in the back part of the book about things that employees can do to protect themselves, as well as what companies should do to fix this. And so, you know, I think culturally, we have a scenario where the people that raise the issue become the problem. Mm-hmm. And most of the time, all that the person that's raising the issue wants to have happen is one of two things. They want the behavior to stop, because at the end of the day, particularly, you know, in a harassment case, which happens predominantly to women, all we want is to be able to come to work, do our job, and do it in an environment that is safe and dignified and where we're not putting up with this crap, right? So that's number one. And number two is that in 75% of those cases, when women do come forward, there is retaliation. Most of the time, and I can speak for myself, but the reason that I brought this forward was to protect the organization. I raised the issue during the initial interview with this candidate, where I said, I think this guy might be a problem. And they hired him, right? So at every step of the way, there were opportunities for them to fix it. But I think we need to change the narrative. We need to shift the paradigm and recognize an incentive and reward the people that step up to call this behavior out. Because if the company takes it seriously and they listen to these people, they do their diligence and they rid the culture of these people, it's better for the company in the long run. It protects them legally. It gives them better grounds to stand on culturally. Employee morale will spike. You know, you take away all of the things that are symptoms of this behavior when you address it properly. But yet we treat these people like pariahs, and we need to change that.
So much of your story, you know, everything from the CEO eventual payout on down, the lawsuits, goes back to if you put processes in place. I mean, one of them, the CEO actually had a decent point in saying, hey, Lisa, go talk to this person. But the process also, in addition to listening to your concerns, validating them, using them as part of their mindset and realizing, okay, I don't have all the great ideas here. I want the feedback of my people in the interview process. If you've got a giant red flag, okay, maybe they view your red flag as a part of it. But that would also cause a smart leader to say, all right, I'm hearing something here. I want to get more people involved in this interview process and either trust you 100% or say, you know, let me get two more people to find out what kind of vibe they're getting. Let's collectively hire this person almost as a team to say, we want the strongest person, and we sure as heck don't want somebody who is setting off alarms throughout from their interview process on through chasing people from the organization. There's a process pattern as well as the just abhorrent values, just some basic guidelines, some guardrails for how an organization should be led, and missing every step of the way.
Yeah, and two counterpoints to that. So this candidate was interviewed by multiple people, one of whom was the CFO, who was male. He also raised some concerns, different concerns, because he hadn't had the sort of underlying sexual tonality with the conversation, but there were some red flags that he raised as a result of his interview with the candidate as well. So that was the first thing. The second thing was that this candidate was internal in that he came from within the United Way system. I happen to know that they never did a background check on him. They never did any of the normal HR processes would do on a campus. Now, there's another problem with the system writ large, which is that there is no mechanism to catch this behavior, right? Yeah. It doesn't show up in a background check. There's nothing that you can run to say that, hey, organization, this person may be a problem. They've got a history of this behavior. That doesn't exist. And that's a huge hole today, huge hole, because there is no way to identify who you're bringing in that may be a problem.
Absolutely. The background check process. I mean, there's so many companies out there. There's so that do it. I mean, Google, for instance, is a background check system where companies can look through and just put in that person's name with, you know, lawsuits that have been filed, talk to their coworkers, their managers, people that have worked for them in the past, all these types of things. But at the end of the day, what you just described, and I heard something just the other day of an organization that was literally 2 days away from hiring somebody into a position of high responsibility that would have had financial control over funds within an organization that just months ago was under criminal investigation for mishandling of money. But you hear about that, and especially in closely held, lightly governed organizations where people are assuming, well, somebody else is doing it, or we don't have the time, or we haven't heard anything bad, so that means something good, and it's just not doing your homework.
No, it's not. And the really scary thing in all of this is that after that first article broke in November of 2020, I had a woman call me. She tracked me down through three layers of mutual contacts, called me, and she said, you don't know me. You know, here's who I am. She said, I saw the story in the HuffPost, and I am sorry. I know it's true because I worked with your harasser years ago, and I recognize the behavior. Now, I never named my harasser publicly, mostly because I think he's kind of nuts and I was afraid for personal safety reasons. But, you know, and what I said to her was, I said, listen, thank you for reaching out, but I never named him. So I'm not sure that you do know. And she said within 10 seconds, she said, oh, yeah, it's so-and-so. And I worked with him in 2005 back at this company. And by the way, he got fired for the same type of behavior. So this guy was a serial harasshole all the way back, right? We're going back years. After this happened, I did speak with people at the local United Way that he had worked for. They'd had issues with him too. And he just cruised on through the system. And I'll tell you, I know where he is now. And he's got an almost all female staff. There's another woman that's going to be subjected to what I want.
Absolutely. Yep. And been, frankly, rewarded by the organization for that behavior. If they know about it and they don't deal with it, they are essentially saying, we are choosing a level of harassment from you over everybody else in the organization.
Lisa, and there was no accountability for him whatsoever. I know we're close to time too.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, but what's one thing looking back that you tell yourself, what's something you've learned?
I think there's two things to that, Pete. I think that number one, one of the key learnings that I had is I didn't know how strong I was until I went through this, right? It's that old saying of if it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger. And so
there were a lot of
scary moments, right? And the character building experience, but I have enough character. I didn't need to go through this. So I think it was understanding how strong I truly am. But the other thing that I really didn't foresee is that speaking up and doing the right thing and protecting my people and following policy and getting fired for it would ultimately translate into some type of career suicide where people are afraid to hire me. I don't think I ever foresaw that coming. And I think it's a really unfortunate statement on our society. Other people that I know that have been whistleblowers or come forward on sexual harassment or financial misdoings at their organizations, whatever it is, they're all in the same scenario where they become the problem. And, you know, what I would say is that What I went through doesn't change my skills or my capabilities or my ability to do really phenomenal work for anybody. If anything, if you're a really good organization that truly does have culture and values people, you should want people like me on your team.
It is a it's a question I encourage listeners to think about it. What you just described is true. Down to a person, I've yet to hear from somebody ever saying the words, yeah, as soon as I spoke up and protected my organization, protected myself, that other job offers were coming in, people were calling up to thank me. It is literally the precise, exact opposite each and every time of I got silence. I couldn't get a call returned. And for those organizations that may be listening, the CEO who may be thinking, we've got challenges, I am not here to be a job posting show, but I would tell you, listen to these stories and weigh the question in your own mind. Do I want to perpetuate a culture that essentially pushes back against people that respect values, protect their organizations? Or do I want an organization that is going to encourage good people speaking up and doing the right thing? And just something to think about as we close. Lisa, I want to thank you for coming on today. I want to thank you for the integrity you've shown. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been the Gas, Glue, and Guardrail Show, the culture, leadership, and careers go-to. And thank you for joining us today. If you loved this show today, and I know you will, there's plenty more episodes wherever you listen to podcasts. I ask you to follow us, give us a 5-star review, and learn from the great people like Lisa who take the time to come on. It's a pleasure helping people around the world get smarter, more prepared, and stronger in their lives and careers. And if you can make an impact and are in a position to do so and help organizations, help workplace culture get stronger, do it. And when you can, as the author of The Arsonist in the Office, I always tell you and encourage you, if you can do so, go put out some fires. Thanks.